Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the March 8, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week has Nikki Haley standing on a platform. In the background, it's a bright, eerie green. She's holding a tattered Republican Party flag on a long metal pole, and she's actually jabbing it down at the crowd that's crowding around her, reaching for her. I guess they're what you would describe as zombies. They've got gray faces and bulging eyes, blood on their faces and hands, and they're also mostly wearing Trump 2024 MAGA hats. So the headline is "Going Out Fighting: Why Haley is Pressing On with Her Doomed Bid for the GOP Nomination." That is our first story. We'll start with that. Haley vows to stay in GOP race despite fresh losses. What happened? Nikki Haley pledged to fight on in the Republican presidential primary this week after suffering decisive losses in Michigan and her home state of South Carolina that effectively ended any chance of a long-shot win over Donald Trump. In South Carolina, where Haley served two terms as governor, Trump took 60% of the vote to her 40%. In Michigan, she fared even worse, pulling 27% to Trump's 68%. That gave Trump commanding wins in five straight primaries, and he holds wide polling leads in every remaining state. With no path forward, Haley faced growing pressure from Republicans to bow out and lost the backing of a political network financed by billionaire Charles Koch. But, she said, she would press on through Super Tuesday, which lands March 5th, when 15 states and one territory go to the polls, telling GOP voters Trump is an agent of chaos who would lose to President Biden in November. "Choosing Trump is like suicide for our country," she said. "If we don't have someone who can win a general election, all we are doing is caving to the socialist left." Biden won Michigan's Democratic primary with 81% of the vote. But more than 100,000 voters in the state, 13% of the total, voted uncommitted, largely to protest his backing of Israel's war in Gaza. Biden beat Trump in Michigan in 2020 by only 154,000 votes. The protest campaign was organized by leaders from the state's substantial Arab American population, along with progressive activists. "He needs to change course," said Hussein Ali, a doctor in Detroit who voted uncommitted, "or he's losing the presidency in November." What the editorial said: "Haley's continuing strength should trouble Trump," said the Wall Street Journal. "The hundreds of thousands who backed her in South Carolina and New Hampshire testify that many Republicans don't want to see him back in the White House. If a meaningful number shun him in November, it could be decisive. Trump should be working to unite the party and courting those voters, but he seems to prefer insulting her as a bird brain on social media." She may be going nowhere, but Haley's continued challenge helps the Republican Party, said the New York Daily News. "Her good faith conservative ideas present a stark contrast to a candidate whose politics are nothing but a garbled primal scream. A former ambassador to the UN, Haley is a stable person who respects the constitutional order, doesn't spew a geyser of dangerous disinformation, and isn't staring down 91 felony counts. She also polls better against Biden than Trump does." You'd think that might shift the Republicans' calculus, but Trump's intoxication seems to prevent voters from seeing clearly. What the columnist said: The Michigan results are a warning shot for Biden and Democrats, said Oliver Laughlin in The Guardian. In just 3 weeks, a hastily organized campaign got more than 100,000 Democrats to pull the lever for uncommitted in a state Trump won in 2016 by just 10,000 votes. It's a clear demonstration of the growing fractures among the diverse coalition that brought Biden to power in 2020. And those fault lines show more signs of expanding than diminishing as the primary season wears on. While Haley is persisting long after previous candidates have thrown in the towel as a puzzle, said W. James Antle in CNN.com. Some speculate she's positioning herself to run in 2028 or to step in should Trump somehow be sidelined before November. But a protracted primary fight that angers Trump's base won't help her in either situation. She's sticking around to drive home one message, said John Podhoretz in commentary, that Trump is a loser leading a party toward a brick wall in November. When he hits it, she'll be there to say, "I told you so," and simultaneously offer a new path to the future. Instead of strategizing, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch, Haley seems to be facing her political mortality in a party that's no longer recognizable to her. The Reaganite GOP grew up and is collapsing around her. Perhaps she feels a moral duty to make the case for traditional conservatism and sound the alarm about Trump's threat to the Republic, trusting that doing so will matter somehow. With nearly every other party member bowing and scraping before the GOP's current standard bearer, she's the last Republican left of any consequence willing to do so. Of course, Super Tuesday has come and gone by the time this show airs, and the news this morning was that Haley is in fact suspending her campaign. Controversy of the week. Ukraine, after 2 years of war, is victory possible for Kyiv? The mood in Ukraine is about as gloomy as it has been since Russia launched its full-scale invasion 2 years ago, said Charlie Diagata and Steve Berryman in CBSNews.com. The war's second anniversary landed just days after one of Kyiv's toughest losses so far, the fall of the eastern city of Avdiivka, taken by Russians after months of bombardment. Russian forces are now probing west, flush with weapons and material from a revitalized defense industry. Ukraine, meanwhile, is running out of ammunition, said Mark Santora in the New York Times, and facing the once unthinkable prospect of waging a long war without American military backing. In the war's early days, buoyed by Ukraine's success, President Biden pledged to supply aid and weapons for as long as it takes to drive out Russian troops. But 2 years and $75 billion later, the lack of military progress is eroding U.S. public support for Kyiv. About 50% of Americans now oppose further aid to Ukraine, including a majority of Republicans. And $61 billion in desperately needed military aid remains stalled in Congress, blocked by the increasingly isolationist House GOP. As Ukraine's fight for survival enters its third bloody year, the forecasts are anything but optimistic. Ukraine faces steep challenges, said Lawrence D. Friedman in Foreign Affairs, but this also remains an incredibly difficult war for Moscow to win. The battle for Avdiivka cost the lives of up to 47,000 Russian soldiers, all to recapture a city now battered beyond habitation. If Russia persists with this strategy, wasting lives for meager territorial gains, it will get harder for Russian President Vladimir Putin to hide the futility of the whole enterprise from his people. Moscow's military losses in Ukraine are already more than four times what the old Soviet army sustained during a decade of war in Afghanistan, said Daniel D. DePetris in MSNBC.com. Some 315,000 personnel have been killed or wounded, more than 90% of Russia's pre-war army, and a third of Russia's Black Sea naval fleet has been disabled. Ukraine's odds of victory may have dimmed, but Russia is losing too. Putin doesn't care about the cost, said Joe Puccino in The Hill. Unlike Western politicians or Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, he can pursue his war effort unshackled by the whims of democracy. With victory assured in this month's sham elections, Putin knows he can keep pouring money and troops into Ukraine for longer than the West can sustain the will to oppose him. Eventually, the spigot of international aid will close, sealing Ukraine's fate. Then there's the matter of Donald Trump, said John Bacon in USA Today. The prospect that this Putin admirer, who has open disdain for international cooperation, could win a second term thickens the ominous cloud over Ukraine's future. Ukraine can still win, said Ella Sherman in Business Insider. If its troops dig in and hold off Russian advances this year, that could buy time for Kyiv to rearm, while attrition takes its toll on Russian troops. In early 2025, Ukraine could potentially negotiate a lasting peace with Russia from a position of strength. Such a settlement may not look like the victory some maximalists have been promising, said Keith Gessen in The New Yorker. But the alternative is the outright Russian victory that seemed imminent 2 years ago. That would have catastrophic consequences for the people of Ukraine and for the West. If a vengeful Putin sees that his dreams of imperial expansion are becoming reality, what will he do next? Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for growing a pear after Israeli scientists working with cells extracted from mice reported they had successfully created a pair of laboratory testicles, raising the prospect of future breakthroughs in male infertility treatments. It was a good week for inflation gauges after a new poll found that the Tooth Fairy has cut its payouts for the first time in 5 years, leaving children an average of $5.84 per tooth, a 6% drop from 2023. It's a good week for water sports. After record rainfall temporarily revived an ancient lake in Death Valley, giving tourists a rare opportunity to splash around in the driest place on earth. This is the first time I've ever kayaked in my life, said Pat Anderson, 73, a visitor from Utah. And to say I did it in Death Valley is hilarious. But it was a bad week for plate appearances after Major League Baseball players expressed mounting concern over the league's new sweat-wicking Vapor Premier uniforms, which become, in the words of the Wall Street Journal, essentially sheer under bright lights. It was a bad week for keeping it together after a Las Vegas man arrested on suspicion of DUI lent weight to those suspicions by urinating on the leg of the arresting officer. Frank Afoa now faces multiple charges, including unlawful acts related to human excrement or bodily fluid. Finally, it was a bad week for pure imagination. After children were left in tears by a $44 a ticket Willy Wonka-themed immersive experience in Scotland, rather than the candy-filled wonderland promised in ads, guests found a sparsely decorated warehouse that some likened to a meth lab. briefing this week is titled A Swatting Epidemic. Hoax callers menace thousands of people a year by getting armed police sent to homes and schools. Can they be stopped? How big a problem is swatting? Since the FBI began tracking such crimes in May, police have reported more than 550 swatting attempts. False emergency calls that claim a mass shooting or other violent crime is underway to draw a response from armed police, often a special weapons and tactics or SWAT team. But that FBI number is likely a vast undercount. U.S. schools alone were swatted more than 770 times in 2023, according to the independent K-12 school shooting database. And the number of hoax calls appears to be rising, with politicians and public figures making up more of the targets. On Christmas Day alone, swatters targeted Boston's Democratic Mayor Michelle Wu, Justice Department Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, and Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene and Brandon Williams, among others. Williams had to emerge from his home with his hands up after an anonymous caller told police he'd shot someone at the lawmaker's address and was ready to kill again. It was an assassination attempt, said Williams. It's not a prank. Most swatting responses end without police using force, but at least two innocent people have died as a result of such calls. One was shot by officers. The other had a heart attack. And many others have suffered bodily injuries and lasting psychological trauma. How did this trend begin? It started in the online gaming community in the early 2000s as some sort of joke, said Lauren Krapf, a tech expert at the Anti-Defamation League. Players would target rivals who were live streaming themselves, thinking it was funny to see a SWAT team arrive at their opponent's door. This form of harassment became so prevalent that some swatters began to advertise their services for hire. In 2017, Tyler Barris of Los Angeles was asked by a Call of Duty player to target a rival in Wichita. The SWAT team arrived at the intended victim's former address and, amid the confusion, fatally shot current resident Andrew Finch, a 28-year-old father of two, as he came to the door. Barris, who charged about $10 per SWAT, was sentenced to 20 years in prison for the murderous hoax. He later admitted to enjoying the thrill of swatting. It was like a kind of online power, he said, knowing that you're breaking the law and knowing that they won't be able to find you and knowing you could do that over and over again. When did it spread beyond gaming? In the early 2010s, swatters made a wave of calls targeting celebrities, including Tom Cruise, Miley Cyrus, and Justin Bieber. At the time, the FBI said most swatters were motivated by bragging rights and ego. But as the list of swatting targets expanded to include schools, hospitals, houses of worship, and political figures, law enforcement analysts noted a growing list of motivations, including personal or social grievances, a general desire to cause havoc and financial gain. On the Telegram messaging app, one swatting for hire group advertises the possibility of extreme harassment for $100 a day. Swatting has also become a favorite weapon of online hate mongers who use it to terrorize their perceived racial and ideological foes. Federal officials in 2020 arrested five members of a neo-Nazi group whose targets had included black churches, a mosque, and a black newspaper columnist. And in a single weekend in December, nearly 200 synagogues and Jewish schools across the country were swatted in a seemingly coordinated campaign. The FBI said the threats appeared to originate outside the U.S. Are many swatters caught? Identifying offenders can be difficult because they have multiple ways to cover their tracks. Swatters often make calls over the internet using a voice over internet protocol service, VOIP, which can provide a phone number that appears to be in the same area code as their victim, and also hide their locations using a virtual private network. A recent wave of school swattings, for example, was traced by investigators to an IP address in Ethiopia. But the perpetrators could have been almost anywhere in the world. Some swatters also use AI-generated or synthesized voices and effects to further disguise their identity. Three Senate office buildings were evacuated last year after a call from overseas reported an ongoing mass shooting. Sounds of people screaming and glass shattering could be heard in the background. Are authorities trying to crack down on swatters? Swatting is not a crime in most states or at the federal level, so suspects are typically charged under statutes that cover threats, fraud, and conspiracy. That requires prosecutors to match the elements of a particular law with what actually is happening, said Lauren Shapiro of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. It's like a puzzle piece way of trying to prosecute the offender. But with swattings against lawmakers rising, Congress seems more motivated to take action against hoaxers. Republican Senators Rick Scott and Tommy Tuberville recently introduced a bill to make swatting punishable by up to 20 years in prison. Beyond criminal sanctions, VOIP services could be required to tighten user identification requirements and emergency dispatchers trained to better filter out fakes. Some police worry that requiring dispatchers to ask extra questions could delay response times in a real emergency and cost lives. But for sci-fi author Patrick Tomlinson, the victim of nearly 50 swatting attempts, the emergency is ongoing. It's taking away our sanctuary, Tomlinson said. We don't know when the door is going to get kicked in. Moving into some of the best columns of the week. Start with a showcase of MAGA horribles. The Conservative Political Action Conference has become an odious shell of its former self, said Matt Lewis. But ignoring it would be a mistake. The annual convention was once a proud institution that gathered the leading voices of the conservative movement. No more. Last week's sparsely attended CPAC was infested by the John Birch Society, Latin American dictators, and neo-Nazis throwing one another salutes. Welcome to the end of democracy, online activist Jack Posobiec declared in a speech, to which Steve Bannon said, Amen. But we can't just dismiss CPAC and move on, because Donald Trump was also there, calling himself a political dissident, and again vowing retribution in a second term. The former president and his enablers have purged the adults from the room and are busy creating the infrastructure to vet and place MAGA types in government positions. These wingnuts are actively being wooed by once respectable conservative groups. While this CPAC may look like a disturbing sideshow, it is really an open call audition for the looniest, most anti-democratic Trump loyalist around. The rotten truth is that more than a few of those people will find themselves in a Trump administration. So hold your nose and pay attention. Voters don't actually care about age. Republicans are making a big mistake if they think zeroing in on President Biden's age is the easy path to victory in November, said Alex Conant. As a Republican strategist who tried to make generational change a winning issue for Senator Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign, I learned the hard way that voters don't really care about leaders' age. Being a geriatric did not keep Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, from getting reelected in 2022 at age 89, or President Ronald Reagan winning a second term at 73. Age is a distant concern so long as voters believe a leader's policies help them. Ask Nikki Haley. She tried and failed to make the age argument stick against Donald Trump, 77, who, unlike some Republicans, seems to instinctively understand that it's not his best line of attack against Biden. Two scenarios would shift this calculus. If Republicans can persuade Americans that the president is mishandling issues they care about because of his age, or if Biden experiences a high-stakes senior moment that creates legitimate concerns about his fitness for office. Sure, that could happen, but Republicans who count on it are not in control of their own destiny and would do better to shift tactics. This column comes from Germany. Legal weed, but only for non-drivers. I have good news and bad news for stoners, said Andreas Schmidt. The good news is that marijuana will be legal in Germany as of April 1st, putting an end to decades of senseless arrests and prosecutions. So go ahead and light up. Just don't plan on going anywhere after you indulge. Because the bad news is that the threshold for driving under the influence is far too low. Under the new law passed this week in the Bundestag, it's illegal to get behind the wheel with any THC detectable in your blood. Not even 1 nanogram per milliliter. That's such a minuscule concentration that you could test positive for a joint you'd smoked 3 days prior, even though you'd be perfectly fit to drive. The government structured the law that way to avoid a veto by the more conservative upper house of the legislature, the Bundesrat. As written, with zero tolerance, the Cannabis Act doesn't require Bundesrat approval. But if a THC level safe for driving were written into it, it would count as a traffic law, and the Bundesrat, packed with conservatives, would be able to intervene. In a loophole, though, the Bundestag will be able to add a new minimum THC level later this spring, once a science panel has weighed in. Until then, we still effectively have a weed ban through the back door. Last word, our long form piece. This place breaks your heart every day. A family ranch in Arizona has become a gateway for desperate migrants entering the U.S., said Eli Saslow in the New York Times, and for cartels smuggling drugs across the border. Aravaca, Arizona. Jim Chilton, 84, had named the dirt roads and pastures on his land in honor of 4 generations of family cattle ranchers. But now he prepared to drive across his ranch on the U.S. border, unsure of what he might find. He packed a handgun in case he encountered more smugglers working with the Sinaloa cartel, and bottles of water for the migrants he'd recently seen lost and dehydrated in the Sonoran Desert. "Do you have your satellite phone?" asked his wife, Sue Chilton, 81. There was no cell service on most of the ranch and no other homes for several miles. "I'll take it with me, but assume no news is good news." His plan for the day was to survey 3 remote water tanks and locate a few lost cows. Simple tasks in a place where everything had become increasingly complicated during the past several months. Chilton laid out a map of southern Arizona on the hood of his truck and showed his wife the route he planned to take across their cattle grazing land, an area 3 times the size of Manhattan, located on the outskirts of Aravaca. He traced his finger over a desolate mountain range across 6 canyons and down to the 5.5 miles of their ranch that ran along the U.S.-Mexico border in what had become one of the busiest corridors for a record wave of illegal immigration. The Chiltons had spent the past several years trying to unravel the mysteries of their own backyard as the situation worsened on their ranch. They discovered drugs and at least 150 smuggling trails on their grazing land, so they put up security cameras and offered to arm all five of their working cowboys. Those cowboys started to see groups of migrants stranded near the border, so the Chiltons installed water fountains in the desert to help keep people alive. Their security cameras recorded hundreds of men walking by each month in camouflage, so they testified before Congress and campaigned alongside Donald Trump for a wall, hoping it might slow the procession of people onto their ranch. But now more immigrants entering the country illegally were crossing the southern border than ever before. Recently, Border Patrol agents estimated that as many as 250 people each day were arriving on the remote corners of the Chiltons Ranch after being led across the border by paid guides working on behalf of the Sinaloa cartel. "I'll be back in 5 or 6 hours," Chilton said. He waved to his wife and turned onto a dirt road headed south. Chilton descended into Chimney Canyon, where a few years earlier a Border Patrol agent came upon a group of drug smugglers and was shot 5 times. Chilton continued driving over a hillside where he remembered hearing a child from Honduras screaming for help and following that boy over to his mother, who was dying of complications from diabetes. He stopped to check a water tank in the shadow of the 32-foot-tall steel border wall that Trump built as president. One of Chilton's cowboys had been checking the same tank a few years back when smugglers jumped him and allegedly threatened to come after his family unless he started transporting drugs. The smugglers stuffed 44 pounds of methamphetamine into the cowboy's spare tire, and he made drug runs until the Border Patrol arrested him. Just when you think you've seen everything, this place still shocks you," Chilton said. He turned onto a rugged road that paralleled the border wall and drove for a few more miles until he saw a campfire burning in the distance. He was on the most remote corner of one of the most remote ranches in America. But as he drove closer, he counted more than 45 people sitting near the fire. Children shouted in French. A woman prayed in Arabic. "What in the world is going on?" Chilton wondered. Brian Best, 64, recognized Chilton's truck and walked away from the campfire to flag him down. Best was a volunteer aid worker from Tucson, part of a group called Tucson Samaritans, and lately he'd been spending 2 days each week on the border road as the first and sometimes only American to greet immigrants entering the country illegally, who were crossing in historic numbers. The border wall was now compromised every few miles by rope ladders, small tunnels, gaps awaiting construction, and new pathways cut every few nights by smugglers. One of them was a 3-by-3-foot hole that led to a patch of saguaro cactuses and mesquite trees on the Chilton Ranch. Best had watched cartel guides lead more than 170 people through that opening in the past few hours, including dozens of women and children who said they planned to seek asylum in the United States. They were fleeing civil war in Sudan, caste discrimination in India, starvation in rural Guinea, and organized crime in Albania. During the coronavirus pandemic, Trump invoked a public health rule called Title 42 that allowed agents to turn away migrants at the border. Over 3 years, the U.S. used Title 42 to turn back people more than 2.8 million times. But the Biden administration allowed Title 42 to expire last May, and border policy defaulted to the previous standard, which allows most asylum seekers to stay in America while their cases play out in the court system. Soon after, Best started running into large groups of migrants near the border wall that often include women and children from all over the world. Almost half came from West Africa or Asia. By late December, the Tucson sector of the Border Patrol was encountering almost 20,000 migrants in a single week, a 300% increase over the last year, and nearly 10 times as many encounters as in the average week in 2021. Best handed out granola bars as he watched a mother and her four-year-old draw smiley faces with sticks in the dirt. He handed out fruit and added wood to the campfire as a group of men from Guinea removed their socks to warm their feet. The men said they had pooled their life savings to fly from Istanbul to Bogota, Colombia, to Nicaragua. They had spent 12 nights sleeping in the Mexican desert before crossing the border with the help of cartel guides, who they said stole what little money they had left before pointing them through the fence. "Someone is coming to get us soon?" one of the men asked Best in English. He replied that he hoped so, but he could not be sure. "This place breaks your heart every day," Best told Chilton. "They're exhausted, they're sick, they're confused, they're cold, and they just have to wait. How can this be our system?" The Chiltons had thought about selling. They had considered moving closer to friends in Tucson or grandchildren in Los Angeles. But Jim had been ranching since his father gave him a saddle at 5, and he had kept getting back on a horse even after he was bucked off and broke 4 ribs in his late 70s. For years he thought he could overcome the border problems too, if only the right people listened. He gave speeches at his church, took politicians on tours of his ranch, and celebrated the construction of Trump's wall. But parts of that wall remained unfinished, and other parts were riddled with gaps. And now the Border Patrol was preoccupied with the record number of asylum seekers at the border. Despite 3 decades of activism, he believed most of his ranch was less secure than ever. He had taken to monitoring the cameras he had hidden on 5 of the ranch's 150 smuggling trails. And now he opened his laptop and called Sue in the kitchen to review the motion-activated footage from the past several months. "This is mostly from down by the corrals in that nice little oasis," he said. "With the deer grass and the beautiful emery oak," Sue said. "It looks like we have at least an hour of images," Jim said, as he hit play. In total, the cameras had collected images of more than 1,000 people crossing on those 5 trails, a tiny sample of what the United Nations considers the largest global movement of displaced people since the 1950s, with millions fleeing gangs, economic collapse, and political instability around the world. "It's a multi-ring circus, never mind just 3, Sue said. "It's hard to watch, given all the possibilities," Jim said. Their house had been broken into 3 times. Once, all that was missing was food and apple cider. Another time, someone had stolen several guns. Sue watched the parade march across the screen and close the laptop. "I already think about it," she said. "I dream about it. That's enough." She got up from the kitchen table, and Jim followed her to their circular bedroom, which perched on a hill overlooking the ranch. They had installed 18 windows with views in every direction so they could watch their herd migrate across the desert and storms roll in from Mexico. "The skyline is our fence line," Jim liked to say, and for years they had found peace in their solitude. But now the sun was dropping over the mountains, and Jim looked into the dying light and wondered who might be out there. Another night, another few hundred people arriving on the back corner of the Chilton's ranch, and Fatma Ali stepped through a hole in the wall and sat on a rock to get her bearings. It was 36 degrees, colder than it had ever been back home in Chad. She saw a cow grazing in the distance. She saw a handwritten sign that said there were 22 kilometers from a Border Patrol station in Sasabi, Arizona. But their group of 24 Africans had already been walking for many hours and could walk no more. One of them had a high fever. One had twisted his ankle. One was a 2-year-old who hadn't eaten all day, and one was a pregnant woman from Sudan named Rania Mohammed, who clutched her stomach, lay down on an abandoned wooden pallet, and slipped in and out of consciousness for a few hours until a Border Patrol van came over the hill. "She's dizzy because she walks so much," Ali told Border Patrol agents. "She's sick and exhausted. She's pregnant and feeling lots of pain." Mohammed was already 9 months along, and the agents huddled to discuss their options while Ali held her hand and prayed with her in Arabic. "God will protect us," Ali told Mohammed in Arabic, which was a version of what Ali had been repeating to herself for the past 3 months. Ever since her relatives pooled their savings so one member of the family could flee the abuses and abject poverty of their life in rural Chad. Ali had been chosen to go because she, too, was pregnant, and because she had taught herself to speak English as a child by watching American cartoons. She boarded a flight to Istanbul and another to Bogota. She suffered a miscarriage somewhere between Nicaragua and Honduras. She was robbed in Mexico. After 52 days of travel, she had arrived in the United States with neither a destination nor a plan. The only people she knew in America were the half-dozen friends she had made on the migrant trail, one of whom was now lying on her back and writhing in pain on the Chilton's ranch. "Does she think she's in labor?" an agent asked Ali. "She's not sure," Ali said. She explained that Mohammed was anemic and that all three of her previous pregnancies had ended in C-sections. "Okay, we need to move," the agent said. He loaded Ali, Mohammed, and the two-year-old into the van and told the rest of their group to wait on the road until more agents could come get them. The van started off down the rugged road towards civilization, past other migrants along the way. Dozens of them rushed toward the van to ask for rides, reaching for windows and crying for help. But the van kept moving until the headlights disappeared over a hill, leaving the ranch in the dark. A version of this article originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll read a couple of the health and science pieces this week. NASA returns to the moon via private lander. For the first time in more than 50 years, a U.S. spacecraft has landed on the moon, if not quite upright. The unmanned, phone booth-sized robotic lander Odysseus, made by Texas-based Intuitive Machines, is the first vehicle put on the lunar surface by a private company, part of NASA's partnership with the commercial space industry. There was a last-minute hitch, reports Space.com. With an hour to go before the scheduled landing, controllers realized the lasers intended to determine altitude and velocity for the descent weren't working. So they sent Odysseus on an extra lap around the moon while they uploaded a software patch to allow the craft to repurpose NASA's Doppler LIDAR laser system, which was on board as a demo technology in the landing. "This was a nail-biter, but we are on the surface, and we are transmitting," Intuitive Machines CEO Steve Altemus said. "Welcome to the moon." The craft toppled over onto its side during landing, possibly after one of its legs became snagged in a crevice. But Odysseus was able to transmit images and data back to Earth before running out of power several days earlier than expected. The spacecraft was carrying NASA equipment to gather data ahead of the crewed Artemis lunar missions planned for 2025 and 2026. Despite the landing mishap, Odysseus will give those missions momentum, said NASA astronaut Tracy C. Dyson. "It means we can do it. We're going back." The gnat trapped in the flower. Jack-in-the-pulpit flowers are famous for trapping and killing their pollinators. But a new study shows that the insects also get something out of the relationship, reports New Scientist. The pitcher-shaped plants lure in fungus gnats by mimicking the look and smell of their favorite snack, mushrooms. Once the gnats are inside the flower, they can't get out because the surface of the plant's elongated hood is too waxy to climb, and eventually they die inside. Now scientists have discovered that before they die, the gnats lay their eggs inside the plant they just pollinated. The larva from these eggs will feed on the flower blossom as it decays, and once the hood has shriveled away, the now adult gnats can fly off. Effectively, Jack in the Pulpit kills the adult gnats, but then houses and feeds the young, ensuring another generation of bugs will grow up to pollinate it. Lead author Kenji Shitsugu from Kobe University in Japan says the findings show that the plant-pollinator relationship cannot be neatly categorized as purely mutualistic or antagonistic. And over on the Talking Points page, we have the article IVF ruling. Are frozen embryos children? Alabama's Supreme Court has opened a new chapter in America's fight over reproductive rights, said Tim Craig and Sabrina Molly in the Washington Post, ruling on a case brought by couples who had frozen embryos destroyed in an accident at a Mobile fertility clinic in 2020. The court declared last week that embryos count as children under state law, and so the clinic can be held liable for their wrongful deaths. Human life cannot be wrongfully destroyed without incurring the wrath of a holy God, Chief Justice Tom Parker wrote in an opinion that repeatedly referenced scripture and divine will. The ruling has dire implications for the state's in vitro fertilization, IVF providers, and for the many would-be parents who hope to become pregnant through the procedure. In a typical IVF process, eggs and sperm are combined in a lab to create embryos. One or more of those embryos is then implanted in a woman's uterus. Extra embryos are frozen for possible future use or discarded if they have genetic abnormalities or are no longer needed by the patients. Fearing that they can now face civil or criminal charges, three fertility providers in Alabama, including the University of Alabama at Birmingham, the state's largest hospital, have suspended IVF services. The consequences of this ruling may be profound, said Mary Ziegler in CNN.com. This is the first high court ruling to assert that life begins at conception, a bedrock tenet of many abortion opponents. Other red states could now follow suit. And it will fuel a broader effort by conservative activists to establish fetal personhood, the principle that a fetus or even a frozen embryo is a person, entitled to constitutional protections under federal law. The more fetal personhood is recognized, the more kinds of reproductive decision-making will be a crime, including abortion and some forms of birth control. It's grimly ironic that religious conservatives who believe a woman's greatest purpose is giving birth are derailing IVF treatments, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. More than 97,000 children were born nationwide via IVF in 2021, which should delight the supposedly pro-life crowd. But what the Christian right really wants is not motherhood per se, but a social order where women are second-class citizens. This isn't about controlling women, said Ian Haworth in the Washington Examiner. It's about protecting human life. No matter how much abortion rights advocates try to spin the matter, life begins at conception. It follows that embryos are humans with the same unalienable rights as a walking, talking adult. A national reckoning with an IVF industry built on the deliberate destruction of human embryos is overdue, said National Review in an editorial. Babies born through IVF have brought great joy into the world, but it screams of a moral blind spot to celebrate them while ignoring the plight of the unborn brothers and sisters discarded along the way. But targeting IVF is politically toxic, said Rachel Bade in Politico, and Republicans know it. One in six Americans has struggled with fertility issues, and polling shows IVF as overwhelming support among voters, including 83% of evangelicals and 78% of those who call themselves pro-life. That explains why Donald Trump quickly proclaimed his support for IVF and why Alabama lawmakers rushed to introduce bills clarifying that an embryo is not a life unless it's implanted in a uterus. They can try to run away, but Trump and the Republicans own this decision, said Nia Malika Henderson in Bloomberg. Voters know it would never have happened without Trump's ultra-conservative appointments to the Supreme Court, who cast the decisive votes on overturning Roe v. Wade. Having unleashed big government on women's bodies and on American families, Republicans should bear the electoral fury over Alabama and whatever comes in its wake. The extreme theocratic actions of the Alabama Supreme Court are just a start, said Max Burns in The Hill. With a sweeping ruling that reads like a biblical sermon, the justices made clearer than ever that Republicans are at war with our fundamental separation of church and state. An ascendant Christian nationalist movement is bent on installing a theocratic government that would reshape every aspect of American life and law. At this very moment, conservative think tanks are building a roadmap for integrating Christian nationalist principles into a second Trump administration. If they prevail, nothing less than the right to a private life is at risk, said Sarah Jones in New York Magazine. The influential Heritage Foundation has called for ending what it deems recreational sex and senseless use of birth control pills, while Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has said the court should revisit rulings guaranteeing the right to contraception and same-sex marriage. What lies ahead is total war, and not just on women. Propaganda. Did Russia ensnare the GOP? Are Republicans easy marks or willing participants in Russian anti-Biden operations? Asked Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. That's a troubling question raised by the recent indictment of former FBI informant Alexander Smirnov, Republicans' star witness in the impeachment inquiry targeting President Biden. The probe had been utterly lacking in evidence that Biden profited from his family's foreign business affairs, except for Smirnov's claim that the Ukrainian energy company Burisma, where Hunter Biden was a board member, paid his father and then President Vice President Joe Biden $5 million in bribes. Now Smirnov is charged with relaying accusations that seem to have been cooked up by Russian intelligence, including compromise to damage Biden in the 2024 election. This is the same kind of influence scheme Russia used to brazenly interfere on Republicans' behalf in the 2016 and 2020 elections. House Republicans may have got out over their skis trying to pin their case on Smirnov, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. But they were abetted by galactic government incompetence. It took 3 years for the FBI to see that travel records it had in hand proved that Smirnov was lying about meeting with Burisma executives. And while FBI Director Christopher Wray ultimately tried to warn top House Republicans, James Comer and Jim Jordan, that Smirnov's claims were unverified, the GOP doesn't trust the FBI, since so much of what was said to be Russian disinformation, like the embarrassing contents of Hunter's laptop, proved legitimate. Anyway, Comer and Jordan never needed Smirnov's allegations because there is already extensive evidence, having nothing to do with Smirnov, of corrupt Biden family influence peddling. We're going to see Russian propaganda of every kind ramp up in advance of the 2024 election, said Dan DeLuce and Kevin Collier in NBCNews.com. Once again, Moscow is deploying fake online accounts and bots to damage Biden and exacerbate American political divisions, especially over continued military aid for Ukraine. And it has succeeded in insinuating Russian state rhetoric about the evils of Ukraine and NATO into GOP talking points. Republicans seem unconcerned about collaborating, colluding with a Kremlin operation, said David Corn and Mother Jones. After all, one helped get Trump elected in 2016. The Smirnoff case shows not only that Trump and the GOP are Putin dupes, they are willing dupes. A short note or two. There has been almost no ice in the Great Lakes this winter, a result of climate change and the El Nino weather pattern raising temperatures far above the average in the region. Total ice coverage reached 2.7% in mid-February, far below the typical late winter peak of 53%. Millionaires and billionaires in the U.S. are underpaying their taxes by more than $150 billion a year, according to the head of the Internal Revenue Service. Audits of taxpayers making more than $1 million a year fell by more than 80% over the past decade due to IRS budget cuts, while the number of taxpayers in that bracket jumped 50%. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from author Cormac McCarthy. He says, "You never know what worse luck, your bad luck, has saved you from." Think on that one a little bit. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And, as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.